is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll chat with film instructor and director Garrett Bradley about her award-winning short documentary, Alone. Then Jessica Rosegard checks in with Richard Campanella to discuss his Cityscapes column for NOLA.com, The Times-Picayune. And we'll share another episode of The Listening Post. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. Stay with us. Loyola University's film instructor Garrett Bradley is the award-winning director of Alone, a documentary short film focused on mass incarceration and its shaping of love within the modern Black family. She joins me now to discuss the short doc and her recent accolades. Garrett, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Your award-winning short documentary, Alone, focuses on the prison system here in Louisiana and its impact on Black families, but from the perspective of a single Black mother. All within 13 minutes. As a director, what inspired you to share that reality?
My entry point actually was kind of twofold. Desmond, who had been incarcerated and was Lon's partner, I had met back in 2010, actually, in making my first feature-length film, Below Dreams, which I moved to New Orleans to make. And I met Desmond through Craigslist, and it was a narrative film, narrative feature film, premiered at Tribeca in 2014. Mm-hmm. And he acted in it, and I stayed close with him, as I do many people that I work with. And I met Lon through him and became very close friends with her through him. So she called me one day and said that he'd been, you know, locked up. And I initially had just kind of stepped in as a friend to help her with really basic day-to-day stuff, however I could. A lot of people don't realize that when you are brought to jail, whether you're innocent or guilty, you essentially become a missing person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your bills are still expected to get paid. You're still expected to pick up your cell phone to go to work. And when you disappear, there's no other way for people to reach you except for through this partner who essentially has to take on a very large burden overnight. So having to experience that firsthand, to see what she was going through as an overnight single mother, to see the spelling of her name, which was spelled Alone. And then to also think about my own experience at the time, which was breaking up with someone I'd been with for a very long time that I was still very much in love with, not being able to be with them, and yet having these resources like my friends and my family and meditation and books and all sorts of places that I could go to deal with my pain. Lon had nowhere to go. She also was in love with someone who she couldn't physically be with, and there was so much shame and stigma associated with being with someone who was incarcerated, regardless of their innocence, that she had no one to talk to, and that felt fundamentally unfair.
Again, this hits pretty closely for you because this is your friend. Is this the first piece of work that was close to you like this?
That's a really good question, because it is, actually, and I'd never thought about that until you asked it. But I'll say that everything that I do, I am connected to. And part of what brings me to making films is that there is a universal connection with all of us. That's what motivates me on a creative level.
As we continue to talk about Alone, I want to mention that you released it nearly a year ago on Valentine's Day. Let's talk about why it was Valentine's Day.
Releasing the film on Valentine's Day was really crucial for us because the premise of the story was that Lon was alone and she felt that there was nowhere that she could go to share her experience. And yet we've got almost 70% of our population incarcerated. That means that at least one, if not more, of those people are also serving time on the outside. We aren't alone. There's mm-hmm. actually many of us that are living these parallel lives. So Valentine's Day actually became an opportunity for us to say, hey, why don't we just come out? Why don't we contribute a new dimension to what love means and a new conversation to what love can look like? And Lauren Domino, our producer, really was the genius behind that.
So speaking of Valentine's Day, let's talk about those ideas on love, because within your short doc, the main character went to her mother to tell her that she was going to marry the guy in jail. Let's talk about how some people may not see that as love.
Yeah, so that's a really good point. So there are examples throughout the film, the one that you've just mentioned in particular, that a lot of people talk about. So Lon goes to her house to go tell her mother that she's making a choice to marry Desmond, and her grandmother is there. So we have a scene essentially of three generations of women who have experienced similar things, or at least been privy to what it means to be in love with someone who's been entrenched in the system. And we hear her mother's frustration and fear and angst, and I think hopelessness to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. which is to say that, yes, she's cursing and she's yelling and she's passionate, but what she's really saying is that how is it that I can spend my entire life trying to make sure that you stay safe and out of the system, and you still have found a way to become entrenched in it. It still has found its grip on you. And the inevitability of that and the frustration that comes from that was really important that people see. And you're right, some audiences see it and feel like this is abuse. You know, how could she speak to her daughter like that? Others see it and completely understand. And that is what love is. It's a complex thing, and we all process it in different ways. And love and anger and hatred, they're all intertwined into each other.
Your recent films and this one have received a bunch of awards, but your recent award is the 2017 Sundance Award, and that's huge. Let's talk about your Sundance experience.
One thing I'll say about Sundance is that everybody hates Sundance until they get into Sundance, and then they love Sundance. And I will say that I was definitely one of those people. And, you know, not that I hated it, but, you know, you send your work and there's sort of this Goliath force in the world. And there's a lot of people that are out there trying to make work specifically for the festival. But I spent a very long time, you know, making work that really was, to a certain extent, going against the grain aesthetically. You know, I'll never forget watching the film, all of us sort of internally before it premiered. And I think one of the most striking and important moments, maybe even more so than winning the award, was seeing Lawton's lawyer actually cry after seeing the film and sort of recount, you know, that what it means for her to do her job effectively is to essentially disengage, and that seeing the film pushed her to ask, maybe I can do my job just as well in a different kind of way when I am engaged. Maybe that disengagement, that sort of objectivity that's required of me, is doing me a disservice. And that the more we can connect the emotionality of a situation for every person's life, even if that seems exhausting, we can actually do better. Mm-hmm. And an award doesn't necessarily do that for the world. It doesn't do that for society. It doesn't do that for anybody who's incarcerated or who's serving time from the outside. But it does push the narrative out there to the public. And if there's anything that Sundance did, there's anything that award did, it was that.
Now, I read about three articles on you, and they all described you with the same three words, one to watch. What's next for you?
What's next for me? I mean, I'm always working on multiple things. You know, I think it's really important, and I always tell this to young people in particular, you don't want to have tunnel vision on one project. You know, my first feature, Below Dreams, I mean, I was lucky enough to have a partner who supported me through that process, but it was really difficult, I think, because I was only working on one thing. I was only seeing one thing. So from that point on, I've always had at least three or four things that I'm working on simultaneously. But I think more importantly, what is next for me is a new way of saying the same thing I've always been saying, which is, how can we use the medium to bring people together? And that sounds really one-on-one and kind of corny, but what I'm really trying to say is that we physically live in separate spaces. And when you create a screen, right, when you have this square, you actually have the opportunity through editing and through film work to intersect thoughts and ideas and spaces in a way that the real world doesn't allow for. So I'm trying to use that as much as I can to get people to start to understand each other and to hear each other out.
That was Garrett Bradley, award-winning director and film instructor at Loyola University. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
You can watch Bradley's award-winning short doc, Alone, by visiting nytimes.com/alone. Time for our monthly check-in with Richard Campanella, geographer with the Tulane School of Architecture. Campanella is the author of Cityscapes, A Geographer's View of the New Orleans Area, a column published monthly by NOLA.com, The Times-Picayune. His latest installment is about the development of the Industrial Canal. Here's WWNO's Jessica Rosegard.
Richard, we're discussing your story about the Industrial Canal, and you talk in your piece about how radical the idea for this canal was 100 years ago.
It was indeed. It would literally cut the city in half. It would also detach the entire East Bank lower portion of the Deltaic Plain from the rest of the region and the continent. That said, it was also a very old dream, going back as early as, incredibly, 1721, a few years after the city was established, to connect river and lake. And you could find maps that actually depict such a connection in place. Of course, they were speculative or proposed. So we see one from 1721. We have another plan. Now, this dates to 1807. And in an act of Congress that year, it was very clearly spelled out that the Carondelet Canal would be extended around Basin Street and then connecting with a to-be-laid-out boulevard that would have an especially wide corridor allowing for a 60-foot right-of-way. Thankfully, that waterway was never built because the technology for the lock was not yet in place, the finances weren't there, and a lock would definitely be needed because the river goes from about 1 foot above sea level up to 20 feet. Of course, like Pontchartrain is at sea level. Had the two been connected without the right apparatus there, there is a chance that engineers could have lost control of the high water on the river, and it could have really severed the city in half.
And this is a very distinct difference with the other canals that we've talked about, right? Because of the river.
Absolutely. This one needs a lock. Anything on the river, at least in this sort of hydrology, would need a lock. And so that project never happened, but the idea of it lives on in the name of Canal Street. So the dream lingers. A couple of the surrounding parishes try to make the connection. And finally, one is actually created in extending Bayou Dupree to become what is now the Violet Canal. And that connects the Mississippi and Lower St. Bernard Parish with Lake Bourne. So meanwhile, officials in New Orleans are watching this closely. And what happens in 1896 is there's a massive change in the administration of the Port of New Orleans. It shifts from local city control to becoming the state agency that it is today, the Port of New Orleans. And so the dock board, the commissioners of the Port of New Orleans are aggressively trying to modernize the port, keep up with other ones. They want to make a call at the Port of New Orleans as efficient, cheap as possible. And the movement at that time was to build these inner harbors, these seaways. And so in 1914, the state approves the excavation of what to this day is technically called the Inner Harbor Navigation Canal. And it was nicknamed almost from the start, before it was even built, the Industrial Canal, as kind of a branding for public consumption, that this is going to bring in industry. And so the idea here was indeed to connect river and lake, but first and foremost, it was to create deep draft, stable level, as opposed to the river going up and down, dock space, easily leasable dock space. So it opens up fully in 1923, and it's in the subsequent years and decades that we see the development of more and more port infrastructure, either opening up anew or relocating off the river into these all these new, very attractive leasing opportunities and water access. In the late 30s and 1940s, the Industrial Canal is joined by the newly excavated Gulf Intracoastal Waterway that allows barge traffic to travel from Texas to Florida. 20 years after that, the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet Canal is excavated to allow ocean-going ships a direct shot into this same eastern complex of where the Gulf Intracoastal Waterway joins the Industrial Canal. Such by the late 60s, early 70s, there's this remarkable vision, a real draconian change in the geography of the city to relocate most port activity off the Mississippi River with new containerization technology and the need for intermodal railroad and interstate access to the juncture of the Industrial Canal, the Intracoastal Waterway, and the MRGO.
Did that actually play out that way?
No, it didn't. The reason was the MRGO had hydrological problems. It kept widening. It kept requiring costly dredging. It was catastrophic in that it introduced Gulf salt water. It killed off freshwater marshes and swamps. What originally was the linchpin of this whole central port idea of moving the port to the east instead became its most vulnerable element. And so shipping industries were skeptical about moving all of their infrastructure there when the most important part wasn't reliable. And so by the late 20th century, early 21st century, most of port containerization activity had hunkered down and even built anew on the Mississippi River, the Napoleon Avenue wharf in Nashville. And so we still had some containerization in place at the time of Katrina. And by this time, most of New Orleans had sunk below sea level, even as the Industrial Canal allowed 100 years ago salt water to move into the metropolis at precisely the time it is sinking below sea level. And I think most listeners know the rest of the story, that these three canals created these ingresses, these forays, these entrees for salt water to be pushed by the power of a very powerful tropical storm into the subsiding bowls. And the walls and levees that were there to prevent that from happening failed in all too many places.
What's the long-term sort of legacy of the Industrial Canal?
I think the long-term legacy of the Industrial Canal is a balance sheet of costs and benefits. The benefits are there. There's a lot of pretty decent-paying blue-collar jobs up and down there. It helped keep the Port of New Orleans relevant, and this is in a port city. But you can't recognize those benefits without also recognizing the costs of introducing rising seawater to a sinking metropolis. There were three canals that did that, but the Industrial Canal was the first of them. This is oftentimes the calculus that we have to do in planning new infrastructure and evaluating old infrastructure.
Richard Campanella is a professor of geography at the Tulane School of Architecture. His Cityscapes column can be found every month on NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune. The Listening Post is a community engagement project that creates a conversation around local news. In honor of the tricentennial, The Listening Post wants to know your thoughts on New Orleans' past, present, and future.
Welcome to The Listening Post. I'm your host, Thomas Walsh.
Knowing what I know now, I would go back to the point of desegregation. I would really be more discouraging of giving up the things that we had created that were strong institutionally. I would take the knowledge of that and try to work hard to get people to slow their roll in terms of deciding that everything needed to be something that was, you know, integrated.
That's Carol Bebel, co-founder and executive director of the Ashe Cultural Arts Center, telling us what era in New Orleans she wishes she could revisit. We're inspired by the tricentennial this month and considering New Orleans' past, present, and future. Joining me to talk about our survey results is the crew of Listening Post. Producers Claudia Lopez.
Hello.
And Natalie R.
Hello.
Welcome, guys. Thanks for joining me here. A couple questions to contextualize things. What do we ask our people this month?
This month with Listening Post, we asked, if you could get in a time machine and go back to see any moment in New Orleans history, what would it be and why? A lot of the results that came in were very interesting, whether it be seeing the inception of certain neighborhoods like the Treme or even different traditions that we have around the city.
Kind of brought out the historian in everyone mm-hmm. that we spoke to, didn't it?
Yep. Definitely. We had people who wanted to have participated in some past historical moment. One person said that they would want to be protesting Andrew Jackson's martial law of New Orleans with other locals. Someone said, I would go back to 1727 to meet the Ursuline sisters that came from France. I would love to see their strength and fortitude establishing a hospital in this wild and male-dominated city. And one person even said they'd go back to 1885 in the heart of Lafcadio Hearn's time to have drinks with him at the old Absinthe House as he chronicles the end of the true Creole culture in the French Quarter. And that person noted, I've obviously thought about this.
One person mentioned that they'd like to see the French Quarter being built because they would actually rethink about where to put the French Quarter. For some people, it's about the design of the city. And for others, it's about seeing traditions that have been passed on with their families.
Yeah, I had a friend who said that they wanted to go back to the warehouse in the early 1970s and see David Bowie perform. So sometimes it's really just to kind of get some kicks and have some fun. Other times it's a little bit deeper than that. Natalie, you also had a chance to take this out to public spaces. You went out to the Greenway, not too far from your house. Had a chance to run into some people out there?
Yes, recorded with several wonderful people, and here's one of the responses I got.
Entonces me hubiera gustado mucho esas transiciones. ¿Qué se siente en que tú estás en tu casa y que de repente por decisiones de tus gobernantes solo te dicen ya no eres parte de este, ya sea de la colonia española o la colonia francesa.
So as our resident bilingual, Natalie, can you help us out with this one?
He'd like to see the moments of transition in New Orleans when New Orleans became a Spanish colony, when it became a French colony, and then later when it was bought by the United States, to see what that was like for people who were at home in their space and then, you know, now you're Spanish or now you're French.
Clearly thinking about citizenship here.
Exactly.
So, Claudia, we went to public spaces. We had our text message system where people were able to dial in this month. Where else did we go with this survey? Because I believe you put together a montage for us once again.
Yeah, so a lot of the audio collected this month were at our listening post locations. We have one at the main library on Loyola and also one at the First Cup Cafe on Calhoun.
If I could go back in a time machine, I would like to see the World Fair in New Orleans and ride on the monorail.
I would like to have been a member of one of the indigenous people's families and witnessing Bienville walk from the Bayou St. John and asking him, can we help you?
I'd like to see the Indians, how they developed, how they came about during slavery time. Because my grandfather, mother was an Indian. See that.
Unless you're a white guy, it would have been a bad situation. So I would only be willing to go back to the past if I could go incognito and with a movie camera. I would love to take film of Africans building our city.
My wedding back in 1983.
Maybe I'd be born in the 1890s so that I could be in my teens or 20s, you know, during Storyville era. Just to be a fly on the wall of a brothel in Storyville would be great.
One of the most treacherous streets in the East right now is on Tyra Lane out here. That same street used to have an Olympic-sized swimming pool in the apartment complex over there, two of them. It wasn't a problem to live anywheres out here. Now it is, and that's just being honest.
On to question number two. This one was about the future of New Orleans and what people would hope to see in the future. Guys, what were some of our results for this one?
A couple of people talked about statues. One person said they wanted to see statues of all the greats. And when I asked them what that meant to them, they said some of the great musicians, Louis Armstrong, Son House, Fats Domino, and all the people who, quote, took nothing and made a whole lot of something out of it.
That's fantastic. You know, I was really pleased to see that the most common response was people looking toward the infrastructure of the city, where the city, the roads, the pipes, and the coastline would all be secured so that we are living here and functioning here on a regular basis. Claudia, you put together a nice little montage that kind of addresses this future about where we're going and what people would like to see. Let's get it rolling.
I would love to see the schools going back to their original glory, their original splendor, and also having the people that went to school here taking more of a stance.
I would make a huge investment in culture and art.
Our city government, including the mayor, to do an obvious better job of taking care of the homeless.
If we don't ever take the opportunity to look at where we've come from, then it's really hard to have a clear light down the path to understand where we are.
I would hope to see New Orleans still existing and not underwater.
What I would want to see is like less violence and like all the buildings like redone, like everything that's beautiful. Mainly no violence though.
That'll about do it for this month's edition of The Listening Post. Once again, it's a reminder that this community engagement project can only happen with your participation, so we really encourage you to participate. Claudia, can you tell them how to do that?
You can text us or call us at 504-303-4348. And to find all of our monthly responses and even some of our hilarious social media posts, you can check us out at listeningpostnola.com.
And Natalie, how about our Twitter accounts and everything like that?
You can find us on social media at LP_Nola.
Thank you, thank you, thank you both. So by the time we're back here next time, Carnival will have rolled around, and we hope that you guys will join us here. Claudia, Natalie, thank you both for joining me here in studio. We'll see you next time.
See you next time. Be safe, New Orleans.
All right. Our microphone is your microphone, New Orleans. Thanks for listening.
And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Visit our website to check out previous shows and be sure to catch us next week right here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us.